Good morning, everyone. Happy summer. Welcome to the July 12th, 2017 Safety Officer Teleconference. Thank you for joining the call. I want to mention loud and clear, the call is being recorded to be available for playback later as a podcast. I'm glad that all of you were successful in navigating to the conference with the new access phone number. So my name is Walter Krijalis, President of Aeronomics. I'm your host and discussion moderator. I'm an ISBAO auditor and aviation consultant and attorney, and proud to host these teleconferences as a means for safety officers to get together to compare notes and hear ideas dealing with issues related to aviation safety and safety management systems. Our sponsor for these calls is Allianz Aviation Insurance. I want to thank them for their support. And quickly, some ground rules. Keep the call to 30 minutes. Again, the call is being recorded to be available as a podcast. So with that said, you know, no need to identify yourself with your full name or company name. Just use your first name is fine. And please use your mute button feature on your phone to help cut down annoying background noise. But please remember to unmute yourself when you want to talk. So just to recap, last call 2 weeks ago, we primarily discussed fatigue management and duty time limits for schedulers and others in your department. I'll be posting that podcast later today along with this one. But just wanted to pause for a second. If anyone had any additional comments or questions about fatigue management that we talked about, if so, go ahead and unmute yourself and speak up. Okay, not hearing anyone. Another regular feature is I mention any aviation accidents that might be pertinent to business aviation since our last call, and fortunately it's been a good 2 weeks. I do not see that there were any accidents that occurred, unless there's somebody that has one that did happen, want to mention. Okay. All right, so wow, I think that's the fastest we've done the formalities, 3 minutes. So it's time to open up the call to you guys for any topic you want to discuss. If you're having any particular issue with any of your hazard reports or any other issue, or maybe you just finished an audit and you got a finding that you didn't understand, any issue at all. So somebody unmute yourself and speak up with your first name, and we'll get started.
Well, since there's a dearth of stuff, how about this Air Canada incident at SFO? Is everyone familiar with it?
No, why don't you give us a recap?
Okay.
I don't know about it.
A couple minutes before midnight, an Air Canada flight into SFO did a go-around after he lined up with a parallel taxiway, apparently with four aircraft waiting to take off on that, on the runway he was supposed to land on. It's gotten quite a bit of press, so I'm sure you'll run across it in one of your summaries. But there's not a lot of information out there. It is on Live ATC. I think that's what it is, liveatc.net. You can listen to it. It's like their top hit at the moment. I think from what little I've seen in the newspaper, a contributing factor could be that the parallel runway was closed. The aircraft was cleared to land on 28 right, 28 left. As those of you who may be familiar with San Francisco, is 750 feet between the runways. So it was closed and dark, and perhaps the crew was used to seeing, you know, two sets of lights, and they were landing on the right side. The pilot, it was visual. The pilot queried the tower about, he thought he saw lights on the runway, aircraft lights. The tower responded that the runway was clear and it was his. Shortly thereafter, somebody said, he's lined up on the taxiway, or words to that effect, apparently from one of the aircraft on the parallel taxiway waiting. And the tower told him to go around. He went around and, you know, came back and landed uneventfully 10 minutes later. But there is on the recording, I think United flight number one, who said Air Canada just flew right over us. Now, you know, there's got to be a lot of factors involved. Obviously, no one was hurt, but it had some aviation wag said it could have been the worst disaster in aviation history. If we plowed into four wide bodies waiting for takeoff. And apparently he got down to somewhere between 200 and 175 feet, according to analyses of, you know, flight tracker and those kinds of things, which just showed the aircraft. So he was down pretty low when he started his go-around. Okay, that's what I know. Not much, but apparently nobody else has heard anything, huh?
Wow, well, thanks for that. I did not hear about that yet. I read the morning newspaper. I didn't catch that online.
I think it's on AvWeb. I think you can find it there.
Okay.
Today's.
Anybody have a comment on that?
I mean, I guess, so this is Connor. I guess the kind of the big takeaway, I suppose, is just to, you know, on visual, you know, visual approaches, if there's a precision approach available, to always back it up and verify it, you know, especially if it's late at night and especially if, you know, you're used to seeing a parallel runway that's NOTAM'd closed. So, you know, I'll definitely be interested to see what comes of the investigation. You know, thank God that you know, tower called the go-around. But, yeah, to me, I think the big takeaway there is, you know, follow the SOPs. And, you know, even if that's not an SOP, I think it certainly is the best practice to monitor your position always.
Thanks, Connor. Yeah, back up a visual with the ILS or whatever. The thing that came to my mind when you were saying this, remember back, 10, 15 years ago about the aircraft that back then it was taxiing a position and hold and was at LAX and somebody landed on top of him. You know, night operations and aircraft lighting, when all you have is position lights, there's not much there. and the other thing that came to my mind is who... I mean, to diligently read all the NOTAMs for some of these airports, it's excruciating, you know, to read every closed taxiway, you know. So that could have been as simple as a closed taxiway NOTAM. And, you know, to me, there just seems there has to be a better way. I understand that, like, flightpen.com and some others will highlight, you know, if something is closed or something of significance. But, yeah. Anybody else? All right, well, thanks for that. Something to be aware of. Anybody, unless somebody has another comment to that, has anybody got a new topic they want to bring up? Anything they're dealing with?
Hi, this is Rick. I totally agree with Connor's comments about, you know, if there's any kind of precision approach for the runway that you're you're flying to that should be loaded. But even visual approaches to that runway in the database, will still give you a white line and course guidance. So I think that's imperative that you have something in the runway. Recently, our company adapted another SOP is that we cannot switch runways below 1,000 feet below AGL. So if they clear us to land on a parallel runway or something, we've just decided that there could be too much confusion that we just don't do it anymore. We'll take the go around if something happens there. So I'd add that in.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Okay.
Walter, if you'd like, I can play that tape. It's about a minute long.
Sure, it might be of interest.
All right, well, let me have it here. Stand by. And let me know if it doesn't come through clearly.
Good evening, Canada 759 with you.
I don't quite grasp what was different about 28 left and right and their taxiways that.
Well, there's two parallel runways and two parallel taxiways leading out to those runways on the outboard side, if you will. The runway center lines themselves, as I mentioned, are 750 feet apart. Apparently, 28 left was closed and dark. So, and one of the things I think that will, who knows, obviously these things, there's a compounding effect, but this was basically at midnight on the West Coast. This flight was coming in from Toronto. So talk about your circadian low and fatigue. It was 3 a.m. on the body clock for these pilots. So coming in as a visual, they're looking for, they were basically looking for two runways, and they saw two sets of parallel lights. Now, granted, taxiways are blue, runways are white, there's lots, should have been lots of clues for these guys, but basically they saw two sets of parallel lights, and they lined up with the right one, which unfortunately was a taxiway. I mean, again, too much speculation, not enough facts, but, that's what we have to go on. That's my two cents.
Wow. Interesting. Well, thank you for that. It seems like the tower should have reminded him that 28 left was closed and, it's a single runway operation. All right. Wow. Okay. Anybody, another comment on that or ready to start another topic?
This is Steve. Was the localizer NOTAMed out of service for both runways, or does anybody know that?
I do not. You're right. There's LPV approaches to that runway. There's an ILS to that runway.
Right, but if they were running the tiptoe or the quiet bridge, which are visual approaches, there's guidance there with the localizers.
Absolutely correct. I'm sure Air Canada is going to modify their procedures going forward. It will be up on at least the pilot monitoring display. I mean,
the only other comment as far as SOPs is our SOP, even on a visual approach, we brief whatever approach is applicable, if there is one. And even if you're doing a visual, our briefing is we're doing the ILS to 28 left backed up visually.
You know, this is Walter. Two thoughts come to mind is, I got to imagine Air Canada's got SOPs, you know, and briefing approaches and all that. And, you know, why do most accidents happen? Well, pilot error because a mistake or something was missed or, you know, fatigue or whatever. So, you know, I don't want to superficially kind of figure out what happened there with the Air Canada crew, but what really kind of jumped out to me, just kind of reflecting on listening to that recording, is whoever it was on the frequency set, he's lined up on the taxiway. you know, that, I mean, if you see something, say something, basically. I mean, if it weren't for that call, who knows how much closer it would have got.
Right. And, Walter, all I'm seeing is the local paper had a follow-up story this morning, which indicated that, and again, I don't know whether it's factually correct, but there was only one controller on duty at that point. Now, he had four airplanes lined up on a taxiway, so he was local. He was clearance delivery. You know, he was ground control.
Wow. I'd be amazed that SFO
true.
Gets down to one guy in the cab, which wouldn't, well, it's probably not impossible, but.
Yeah, that is surprising. But, I mean,
yeah.
Again, I'm just repeating what I read in the newspaper. Lord knows they don't always get it right. But, yeah, you're exactly right about whoever the mystery man on the radio was who said, you know, basically, you know, he's lined up on us. It's like, and
you know,
obviously it got the tower guy's attention because, again, those, you know, the tower is sitting essentially 2 miles away from the approach end of that runway, something on that order, you know, whether it's 9,000 feet or, yeah, you know, I don't know, but it's quite a ways. And for him to see the difference between a target lined up on a parallel taxiway versus the runway, that's a pretty sharp eyeballing, I would think.
That's true. I mean, they would have been pretty close for him to say, clearly he's lined up on a taxiway. Or that guy deduced the aircraft lights he's seeing is the ones on the taxiway. And just jumped to the conclusion what they were probably thinking. You know, it is obvious we need to wait for the full report, but discussions like this, I always, you have to take it where, you know, make the presumption that Air Canada in general and that Air Canada crew specifically are the utmost professionals, and, you know, and we have to think if it happened to them, it could happen to any one of us. And it's like, wow, you know, how to prevent that. So,
yeah.
You know, it's too easy to say, oh, they were tired, or oh, or they should have had the localizer tuned in. You know, let's say they did have all that. You know.
Well, the other takeaway for me, Walter, is, you know, trust your gut. I mean, the old, if it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. I mean, and the first thing you hear is the Air Canada crew going, we're seeing lights on the runway.
Yeah.
Confirm we're cleared to land. Yeah. So they, you know, they had, there was something in their visual field that was bothering them. But it wasn't enough, apparently. So, but once again, trust your gut. It's one of my takeaways.
That is a good one. That's a good point. If you're not 100% sure of something, do you want to go there? If something isn't right, and I think we perhaps have all been there at some point in your career where something's going on and you're a two-pilot crew and somehow, I know I've experienced it, whereas like I've lost my situational awareness. I don't know exactly where or what's going on or whatever the case may be. Getting vector, I can't visualize in my head where I am on the map. I'm talking everything's on the screen thing. So you're kind of pausing, waiting for the other guy, while you try to catch up. So I can see that going on too, but I guess it comes down to if you see something, say something. As simple as that. Anybody else? Interesting. I think we've got time for an issue if somebody wants to bring up a new one, or do we have some more points on this one? I always have one ready in case somebody doesn't have something. Anybody? So one I had recently as an auditor was I got some feedback from IBAC when they reviewed the audit report, and basically it was on that chapter 3 on the checklist where with the SMS you must have this, you must have that on the protocol, and it doesn't say anything of that kind in the standard. Just a reminder that the standard prevails, but the protocol is a guide in answering that question. Specifically it was, can you point to a finding that changed something in your ops manual? I don't have it in front of me, but it's I got feedback that there had to be, it was required to show that there was one that changed the ops manual, to which I queried IBAC, is like, there doesn't have to require a change in the ops manual. It's just an indication that it's working. Those questions are more or less just fishing to see, is the SMS working, the risk management system. So, and the other one was the difference between safety goals and safety SPIs as far as there's not that much information in the materials describing the difference between the two. And it is a requirement to have SPIs in the standards, and that is more or less spoken of in a ratio. So many of X per Y, so many stabilized approaches per 100 approaches. It's spoken of in a ratio. So I'm finding that's a requirement that's out there. It may be difficult at times to think up of a meaningful SPI, and I know we've discussed SPIs on previous calls, but I think it's still something that the industry is learning to formulate safety performance indicators and then how to use them. Just curious, does anybody have any story related to that, something where their SPIs worked very well or they like the way it's working for them?
Walter, this is Bob. During my audits, I come across what you're saying rather frequently, where there's a confusion on the operator side of what SPIs are, whether it be safety related or another way. And I always lead people to that document that's in their SMS toolkit of measurement of service providers to give them some guidance on that. But even that document does not differentiate safety versus a KPI, for example. And it's unfortunately here recently, what you're saying has been popping up a little more often, where the feedback from my back has been inconsistent with the what's in the standard, what's in the audit procedures manual, and what's being taught in their classes. So I've been working with the IBAC folks and trying to figure out, I mean, the feedback is good. In my opinion, it should not be mandatory until they either cover it adequately in the standard, cover it adequately in the audit procedures manual, and or cover it in the training. ISBA, folks that run ISBA, seem to do a little bit better job of that than the folks at ISBAIL. So I'm trying to do a little, I don't know if there's a little turf war going on there now. I sense there's differences. I know there's differences how they apply the standards. But hopefully that'll get rectified as time goes on. But I sort of agree. If it's not written anywhere, I would push back and say, look, if you guys want that information, don't penalize the operator today. Put it in the manual in the following revision to allow them to understand what the heck you guys are looking for.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. Yeah, there's a little of inconsistency perhaps right now. The feedback is actually that as an auditor, what we're getting from IBAC is, quite frankly, outstanding. It's very specific, they thoroughly read that report, and I kudos to them, and it is good feedback. And it's important. I agree with you. It's important to have the consistency. And for the operators on the call, just kind of putting it out there, sharing. Sometimes the operators don't see this kind of feedback, except for when a newsletter comes out, which, quite frankly, has been rare. I thought newsletters were going to be a little more frequent from IBAC for guidance. Just taking the opportunity on this call to point it out that, hey, guys, safety performance indicators are required. It is in the standard. To me, it's the standard, the standard, the standard. That's what controls. And everything else is just guidance to the standard. So I still crack up that, the whole risk management chapter, the first two bullet points is three sentences. And that's like 90% of what a flight department does for risk management. So there's a lot of latitude in interpreting how to implement risk management. How the industry practices are important. But to your comment, Bob, if it's going to be mandatory, then write it in the standard. Anybody have a parting comment on that? We're getting close on the time.
Real quick, Bob, again, down the road, you might want to consider taking the time. I don't know how many auditors are actually on your call, but if we get any feedback, you might want to give people an opportunity to share. Have you got any? Because I agree with you. The feedback is very good. Unfortunately, it's to one person. And in some cases, the auditors feel obligated to go back to the operator and get additional information and resubmit it. That one I have a heartburn with. But you might want to consider, having a window, if there are any auditors on board, to share what feedback they do have from week to week.
Yeah. That's a good point, and maybe there's a venue to do that. I want to try to keep this for the operators to discuss their woes. So, all right. Anybody with a last comment before we sign off? All right, it's 12, time to wrap it up. So thank you for all that joined the call, and especially for those of you that shared your comments. I want to thank Allianz again for their sponsorship. Our next scheduled call is in 2 weeks on July 26th. I know that's going to be during the Oshkosh fly-in, but still going to hold it. And remember to use the new dial-in number. Keep your comments and questions coming in. I appreciate any and all feedback you can email me. So in signing off, remember, it's all about identifying hazards and mitigating risks. Thank you, and talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye, guys.
Thank you.